fáilte chrí eile ráis go Gaelic Song Stories, an pod chrúlach far an bimise Deirdre Gréamach a thorst súl ar na scíalachan ar cúlamh na nóran. Hello and a very warm welcome back to the second series of Gaelic Song Stories with me, Deirdre Graham. Throughout this podcast series, I will be looking at more stories and themes behind Scottish Gaelic songs. As a Gaelic singer myself, I have a lifelong affinity with the songs and stories that surrounded me growing up, which have been transmitted through the oral tradition and more recently in recordings and collections. These stories echo across the Highlands, and as I delve into them, I want to take you on a journey to explore the Scottish Gaeltacht and highlight the continuing relevance of these songs. I'll be interviewing some wonderfully knowledgeable guests, each of whom have a keen interest and expertise in several different areas, including war, piping and political struggles, with a good smattering of humour. To start us off this series, I am so pleased to bring you a lovely conversation that I had with singer and former archivist Fiona J. McKenzie. At the time of recording, Fiona was working for the National Trust for Scotland as the archivist at Canna House, which holds the world's largest collection of Gaelic songs collected by folklorists John Lauren Campbell and Margaret Fay Shaw. Fiona attributes the work of Margaret Fay Shaw and John Lauren Campbell as being the sources which inspired her to pursue a career in Gaelic song and folklore. Perhaps the story of John Lauren Campbell deserves an episode in its own right, but today I want to concentrate my attention on Margaret and celebrate her life and take a look at her impressive collection, Folk Songs and Folklore of South Uist. It's late spring and I'm on the Isle of Canna, the westernmost of the small isles archipelago in the Scottish Inner Hebrides. I've taken a walk up to the bluebell woods that the well-known folklorist John Lauren Campbell planted himself in the time that he lived here. It's perfectly serene, with only the sounds of birds and lambs for company. Canna is an island rich in history. The Gaelic bard Alastair MacPhaistear Alastair was the bailie of Canna after Culloden until around 1749. He's said to have composed Beirlín Clanraeg, Clan Ranald's Galley, whilst living on Canna, stranded on what is now Éilean na Bhfearsaigh, under his boat cowering from a storm. Canna is now in the care of the National Trust for Scotland. It was gifted to the Trust in 1981 by John Lauren Campbell and his wife Margaret Fay Shaw, and is still run as a farm with a traditional Hebridean community, as John Campbell requested. There's a beautiful description of Canna House to savour from former archivist and very close friend of the Campbells, Magda Sakrusazu. It says, "The piano that Margaret Fay Shaw played stands in the living room. The collections of periodicals they read are in magazine racks. Jigsaws to be done are on the desk. Gifts from visitors dot the shelves. And bottles of whisky from the SS politician are on the table." So let's just take a moment to soak in these sounds and conjure up an image of this special place. And now to the story of Margaret Fay Shaw, or an Riavac Vic, Little Sparrow as she was known. Fiona, thank you very, very much for having me. First of all, thank you for agreeing to speak to me. And secondly, thank you for your hospitality in having me to stay in your lovely home on this beautiful, beautiful island.
Not at all. Thank you so much for asking me. I'm absolutely delighted to chat to you.
Oh, a topic that you're happy to chat about.
Absolutely. No problem in chatting whatsoever. You won't get rid of me.
Excellent. No, I'm chuffed. I'm chuffed. But I'm so chuffed to be here on Canna. This is my first trip to Canna. Mm-hmm. And it seems very, very special.
It is a special island. And everybody who comes to Canna says that. A lot of people can't sort of articulate why or what it is that makes Canna so special. I mean, it's a beautiful island, but lots of islands are beautiful. Yeah. But there is something really extra specially beautiful about Canna. Mm-hmm. And I think it's more to do with the fact that It's a small island. It feels remote, but not extraordinarily remote. Mm-hmm. It's a green island. And it has, do you know what I always think is the best word to describe Cana is the layers.
Oh,
it has layers of texture, not just in the topography and the geographical layout of the island, but in colours.
Yeah.
The colours, you've got the intense, obviously, like today, the beautiful blue of the sky. And of course, it's like this all year round.
Sorry. I think we've nailed the best summer days possible.
Absolutely. But you've got the green, you know, of the lower down pastures, mm-hmm. of the fields that meet the sea, which mm-hmm. is intensely blue. I mean, it's like the tropical beaches, you know. It's incredible.
The sun is just glittering off the sea
really
today.
It's sparkling, yeah. Absolutely sparkling. But then you've got the sort of the layers of the, you know, when you meet the basalt crags, you meet mm-hmm. the basalt of the hills, and you've got the kind of the sort of gentle layering of the fields up to this complete contrast of stark basalt columns mm-hmm. against the green. And I think you just get an impression of something that is totally unique. It's not one thing or the other. It's just everything. But mm-hmm. more than the colors of the layers of the actual visual things, you've got the layers of the culture and the heritage. Yeah. And you know, you have a living community here, mm-hmm. albeit very small. We currently have 18 people, including one baby, yeah. Of a year old, which is obviously a micro community, mm-hmm. if you want to call it that. But you also have the historical, the layer.
There's a really rich history to this island, dating back, as far as I've read, to St. Columba.
Mm. Yeah. Or even further, okay. Even further back than that. I mean, we have got Neolithic souterrains, for example, in the hills, albeit they've kind of all fallen in now, but we don't know what they were, but they're still, you know, they're evidence of there being people here, mm-hmm. You know, as far back as that. And obviously in more recent times, yes, the St. Columba connection is so strong mm-hmm. as well. You know, part of the island, we know, was a Columban monastic dwelling place. Mm-hmm. There are still remains of that. And we know through lots of research over the last few years that Cana was St. Columba's summer home. He would come here from Iona.
I find that brilliant to think of a saint having a summer home.
I know. Yeah, I know quite. And why, you know, you'd think if he was living on Iona that he'd want to go to somewhere where there were lots of people.
Yeah.
Instead, you go to somewhere even more remote. But obviously he felt there was something very spiritually special about Cana. And a lot of people say that too, although they're not particularly religious. There is something spiritual about it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you feel it, but when I come off the boat, even now, I still feel like something rises out of the ground.
I think for me, I mean, I just arrived in last night off the ferry, and I just, a big grin came over my face as we came in. And, but coming from Skye, you know, I'm just from across the water. And when you talk about the landscape, it's starkly different to Skye.
Yeah.
And yet it's just been over the water from me my whole life. I've heard of Cana my whole life, and it's always somewhere that's intrigued me, but just haven't had the chance to come here. So yeah, perhaps if I'd come here unknowingly and never heard of the place, I don't know what my feeling would be, but there was an expectation when I arrived yesterday.
Yes, yeah.
And also I knew what I was coming for was to come to this great place and have this conversation. So yeah, it felt certainly very special, and just stepping into a different place, a different feeling. We talked a little bit last night about when you go to a place and you get that smell, you just get that atmosphere of a place. I think it's here.
And I think also because Cana, because we don't have the infrastructure, mm-hmm. therefore, you know, we don't have cars on the island. Well, residents have cars, mm-hmm. but visitors can't take cars. So you don't have the traffic. You don't have the traffic smells. You don't have the traffic noise, apart mm-hmm. from maybe a quad bike or the old tractor. You know, so it's like stepping back in time almost, mm-hmm. really, isn't
it? Yeah,
yeah. You know, because this is probably one of the last kind of bastions, if you like, of traditional, really traditional Hebridean community, mm-hmm. in the terms of we don't have those infrastructures. We've got electricity, obviously, and we've got running water, and we've got mm-hmm. Wi-Fi. you know, but we don't have a supermarket down the road. We don't have a coffee shop on the corner. You know, we don't have anything. We don't have libraries or hotels or banks or anything at all. You know, so it is like going back in time, really, which I think is quite special. And I can't really think of any other island community in the Hebrides that has quite got that traditional thing left. Mm-hmm. Most places have got at least some of these things. They've got tarred roads or bin lorries.
Well, that surprised me. I went to Noidert recently, just a few months ago, and that's another place that I felt very special. Not an island, but, you know, accessible by boat, and there's no cars there other than residents. But they had tarred roads.
I tell you what we'd give for a tarred road. Oh, my goodness, yeah. Poor Murdo spends, you know, all his time going up and down the track in his digger, filling in the potholes. Just,
Well, listen, you get the potholes filled in here, though.
Well, this is true.
You're doing better than Sky.
That's true.
Fiona, tell us a little bit about where we are right now, where we're situated.
We are situated right now in what is known as the billiard room in Canna House, which is the big house, if you want to call it that, in inverted commas, on Canna. Canna House was built around about 1863 by Donald McNeill. We don't know for sure exactly when it was built because we don't have the plans, but it was built round about then. And it was built in the style, if you like, of a genteel Victorian villa from the Central Belt, perhaps. A pleasant house. Not massive.
Yeah, that struck me. I thought it was going to be bigger coming up the drive.
Most people do think, because we talk about the big house, don't you? But it's if it was in use as a domestic dwelling, it would be 9 bedrooms. But the boiler room, the billiard room, was built on slightly later than 1863 by the successive family, the Toms of Greenock. And they built this billiard room on as a garden room. It was like a traditional sort of conservatory type room. We have seen a very early photograph of a very fine lady sitting in the window of here in the billiard room with plants growing up the walls, etc. But in later times, the Toms sold Canna, not just Canna House, but the whole of the island, obviously, to John Lorne Campbell and his wife, Margaret Fay Shaw, who came here in 1938 and bought the whole island for £9,000.
Oh, wow. So in 1938,
that was a lot of money.
Yeah.
Plus £2,000 for the stock for the farms, of course.
Wow.
So they came here to continue their folkloring careers, collecting Gaelic song, poetry, story, history, if you like. They wanted, John in particular, wanted to work a traditional Hebridean crofting community, and Canna came up for sale, and he felt that this was a good opportunity to, you know, to do that crofting, to have that crofting life that he wanted. He didn't want the life of the laird, he wanted the life of a farmer.
And he's known as Fer Chanai, a man of Canna.
A man of Canna.
Rather than the laird of
he
Canna.
He didn't want to be known as the laird. He wanted to be known as a man of Canna. Mm-hmm. And that's what he did. You know, he worked Canna as a farm primarily. That was his income. Yeah. That's how he made his living. His folkloring was his real passion, obviously. And you know, it was a means to an end, if you like. He enjoyed his work doing the farm on Canna, but obviously it's quite a hard way to make a living, is to run a farm in the, particularly during the war years, of course. So I've read all his diaries, etc., during the war years, and it was such a hard existence, but it was the folkloring, obviously, which drove him.
Just to go back to you mentioned the war there, because I think sometimes I've been guilty of thinking it mightn't have affected here, but it absolutely did. I was reading in Margaret's autobiography about the submarines.
Yes.
Had, blasted ships just just out of the harbour there, and they took folk in and gave them refuge. And
yes, they did that several times.
Yeah.
And me, Margaret, who was a keen photographer, of course, she was one of the first female photographers of the 20th century.
What a woman.
And, you know, she would go up onto the top of the hill behind us, up on Compass Hill, and she took photographs of submarines going past, you know, this is during the war. And we still have, you know, we've still got those photos. You know, we had shipwrecks just off the coast here. You know, sailors were washed up on shore. And for a small island community, these kind of things were really hard to deal with. They had to deal with, you know, bodies of seamen. What do you do with them when you know, but during wartime, when you can't just leave the island, you know, because of the restrictions, etc., you have to deal with all of this.
I dread as well that the first body that washed ashore, they had identified the sailor from his number and contacted the family to let them know, which is lovely. But they were scolded for it. They were given a row for, they had to report it into
in the right way. Yeah.
And they were told if they hadn't done that, you know, they could have themselves been questioned over the death of, just, you know, things like that. I would never have thought of when you're doing a kind gesture to kind of try and do the right thing.
And also you have the practical things, like if you have a ship, you know, a shipwreck just off the shore of Cana, and you get 12 live, you know, sailors coming on shore, you have a small community. You, during wartime, rationing, you've got to feed them until they can leave the island again or be collected or whatever. You know, so you've got to put up with, you know, dozens of people who instantly double the population of your island and feed them all. So, I mean, we're very lucky. I think Margaret was very lucky that she had a good kitchen garden in Cana House. So she grew a lot during the war. The front garden, we're looking out onto the front garden right now, which is beautifully laid to lawns now. But during wartime, this was laid to crops. And, you know, Margaret took photographs of them cutting the crops with a horse and cart in the garden, you know, and that's how I'm able to identify a lot of these photographs, is just by putting them into context and realising that photograph was taken in wartime. We know that because she had put a date down in it. And so you think, oh, right, so that's why there's a horse and cart in the front garden, was, and you see a haystack in the background. So they were, you know, they were putting the whole garden to use during the war. To feed not just themselves, but, you know, the whole community and any visitors who ended up on the island. So I think that was really part of the whole life of Cana House. It was a centre of, you know, at that time they did grow external crops on Cana. They had potatoes and wheat, but now we have no arable crops at all. It's just animals.
I like that.
Beef cattle and sheep.
Yeah.
Who are much prized still, you know, but
they're lovely.
Yeah, they're so lovely. Even the Swarbles, who are little thugs, big thugs rather, should I say. Yeah, they rule the island, they really do.
That's brilliant.
But, you know, animals were the whole thing in Cana House. You know, Margaret doted on her cats, obviously.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about the cats.
The cats are so important to Cana. And a lot of people don't realise that. I mean, but I don't know if you noticed when you came off the ferry yesterday, if you noticed any of the coloured stone.
No, I've seen one that you pointed out, but I hadn't seen it. But what's the story with the cats?
Well, Margaret bred Siamese cats in particular. So she was very well known for her beautiful Siamese cats. But she did have Moggies too. And although John and Margaret didn't have any children, the cats and dogs became their children. Mm-hmm. And so over the course of 60, 70 years, they must have had hundreds and hundreds of cats. And all of the cats had special names. They were all called names out of all sorts of literature. We had Kinky Poo, and we've got Mrs. Pink, and Sir Poogie Boyd. And the king of them all was Poonie the Siamese, who came to Cana in 1939.
Yeah.
And he lived to be 18 or 19, I think. He died in the early 50s. But a few years ago, I had a residency, a creative residency. So I decided to get 12 stone cats that were about, what, 18 inches tall, mm-hmm. and invited two artists to come and paint them according to the stories of the characters of the cats.
Oh, wow.
So Sir Pudgy Boyd is wearing a beautiful waistcoat and he has an umbrella and a bowler hat. So these cats are dotted around the bay and form a trail for visitors to come and follow. And, you know, it was primarily, I have to say, originally for children, but they've actually been more popular with the adults than they have even with the children. So they provide a lot of interest for visitors who want to know the stories of all these cats. And we have Poonie. Poonie was well known because he's got a bent ear. He had an infection in one ear and his ear was permanently folded over. So even the stone cat has a folded over ear.
Oh, that's lovely.
So the cats are very important. But I mean, the live cats were very important, mm-hmm. you know, to the whole story of Cana House, to the extent that John even recorded Poonie. He had the foresight to actually record Poonie the cat.
Wow.
Expressing his displeasure at the arrival of the new kittens. And so this was recorded, mid-40s, must have been during the wartime. And it's a fantastic recording of Poonie expressing his displeasure and Margaret in the background. Oh, no, John in the background shouting, "Oh, Poonie, you know, those kittens didn't do you any harm." You know, so it's lovely to hear John's voice even in his own recordings.
That's such a nice thing when somebody has, you know, dedicated so much of their own life to recording other people's voices, to then hear their voices. That's
absolutely
special.
There's also another lovely recording which I just stumbled upon of John with a tuning fork, and he's explaining at the beginning of the recording, it was a song recording session in here in Cana House in the early 1950s, and he's explaining how he sets his speed for his recorder machine that he was using at the time. In the 1950s, that would have probably been the Webster. No, not the Webster. Would it have been the Presto recording machine then? Mm-hmm. So he's describing how he has to set the speed.
I need tips from him in setting up this equipment.
And he's using a tuning fork to demonstrate, you know, this is how you'd be able to tell you've got the right speed. I don't know the technology behind it, but he obviously did.
Wow.
And just all these things are just so important, I think, to folklore, because it's not just about songs and stories. Mm-hmm. You know, it's about lives and it's about people's work and how they did their work, you know, 70, 80, 90 years ago. It's how they did and how they adapted. You know, we think that we are the technological, you know, gurus of the 21st century, but actually, you know, we only do today. We've won because we've learned from the past.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, and I think that is so important. And that's what Cana House is all about.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. So tell us a little bit, Fiona, about the archives here then and the kind of legacy that John and Margaret left.
Well, the legacy that they have left us in Cana House is the world's most important archive of Gaelic song, folklore, story, legend. Research. What we have here is beyond par. You will not find what we have anywhere else in the world. It's a sum of 70 years of folkloring in the Hebrides and also in Nova Scotia, of course. They did a lot of work in Nova Scotia. Margaret first came to Scotland in 1920 when she went to school in Helensburgh for a year. And that was where she first heard Gaelic song being sung by Marjorie Kennedy Fraser. And her sister Patufa. Yep. And she wrote about this as a teenager in her school diary and about how it was just the most wonderful music she'd ever heard. But she recognised then that what she was hearing wasn't the pristine version because it was big Victorian piano arrangements with harp and beautiful. But she thought, this is not the real thing.
There's something behind
this. And that was that night she determined that's what she wanted to do with her life. And so between 1920 and 1929, she went on to study classical music. She was a classically trained pianist. But that was going to be her career as a concert pianist in Carnegie Hall in New York. But she contracted rheumatoid arthritis and had to give up her concert playing because her hands were too sore. And she fell into deep depression at that point and couldn't decide what to do with her life. And her doctor eventually said to her, this was about 1923-24, so Margaret, you know, what do you want to do with your life? And she said, I want to find Gaelic song. And he said, well, that's what you need to do. And so in 1929, she came back to Scotland finally and decided, she travelled about a bit and settled on South Uist. This is where she wanted to be. And she lived in North Glendale and South mm-hmm. Lochboisdale for nearly 5 years mm-hmm. with two sisters, Peggy and Mary McRae, living the life of a craftswoman with no electricity, no running water, having to milk the cow, did the whole thing. She lived in the community.
I find that remarkable as well, because she had come from a very privileged, rich, well-to-do family in Glenshaw in
Pittsburgh.
And she just threw herself into this life.
Absolutely.
No qualms.
No qualms about it. No qualms about it. She just felt that this is what she had to do. As you say, she had a privileged background, which didn't mean that she had much money. She didn't, you know, she had to scrabble around in South Uist for an existence as well, mm-hmm. selling her photographs. That's what she did a lot of the time. She,
that's amazing.
Selling her photographs of the people and the landscape and the animals round about her. That's what really drove her on, was she just felt the connection between the people and, you know, their surroundings. And she just wanted to be with them. Yeah. And they respected her for that.
Yeah.
So I think what you often find is when you look at back at folklore collectors, they've come in, they've taken their equipment, they've come into a community, they've maybe stayed for 2 or 3 weeks, and then they go.
Yeah.
Margaret stayed. She stayed.
And she learnt Gaelic.
She listened to the people. She, you know, as far as the recording, and when I say recording, I mean manually recording. She didn't have any recording equipment, electronic. Purely notating it down.
Wow.
And going over it over and over and over and over again until she had it exactly right.
You
know, Mary McRae wouldn't let her off with anything that wasn't exactly right, you know?
Good.
So everything, we know that what we have was just as it was.
Yeah.
And she was the first person to actually do that. To actually, you know, because of her classical training, mm-hmm. she could hear the modes and, you know, the different changes in time signature, etc. She could actually do that. Nobody else had ever really done that before.
Yeah.
She could, you know, she would think, wait a minute, that melody has changed from 6/8 to 2/4, and she did that.
Yep.
She did it. Which is incredibly difficult to do with Gaelic song.
It really is. And she recognises, so she's got a lovely autobiography, The Alleghenies to the Hebrides.
Mm.
A gorgeous book. But she says in that book, and I'm sure through her letters that you've been able to read and her diary entries, that she certainly never shoehorned any of it into a kind of a metric system that suited classical music. She recognised this was a different song type and went back and reflected on it and learnt more about the modes, because, you know, our Gaelic songs have got such peculiar modes if you're not used to it, you know, from an outsider's ear. And she really did the songs a justice.
Absolutely. She worked so hard at just getting them right. Mm-hmm. You know, and she was particularly taken with what we call the little songs, as she described, the little songs that are never heard at songs or ceilidhs or concerts.
Yes.
The little work songs of Piggy and Mary as they go about their daily chores.
Spinning songs.
Yeah, little things.
Songs,
it might just be tiny little snatches of a song.
Yeah.
But she absolutely loved these. And so she, you know, she notated them down for us. So we've got them. Most of the people in the US and in Lochboisdale at the time would have thought, like, you don't want these little songs. You want the big ballads and, you know, the big
bardic praise songs.
Yes, exactly. No, but she said, no, I want the little songs too, because they told her of the people, of their lives, you know, and I think that's just so lovely to be able to do that. Apart from that, they make great teaching songs.
They certainly do.
You know.
But I love singing them.
So do I.
Yeah. I mean, I love the big song, the praise songs as well.
Of course,
They're all wonderful and all have their place. But thank goodness somebody had the foresight to kind of recognise their equal value.
Yeah, as the big songs. Mm-hmm. Yeah, just absolutely fantastic. You know, and her collecting, she actually collected a lot more than we have published in her book, Folk Songs and Folklore of South Uist, which she produced, which she published when she was living on Canna. By that time, she published it in 1954. So there are a lot more songs that she collected, or parts of songs. And that's been part of my delight in working in here over the last 8 years, has been finding scraps of songs.
Oh,
and
yes.
Because I'm a singer myself too,
yeah.
I can recognise, oh, hold on, that belongs with that. Or, you know, she's maybe got two bits of paper ripped out of a notebook and they've got separated. And you think, oh, wait a minute, I've seen that somewhere else, and I can find, yeah, and then put them together. You think,
lovely.
Oh, you know, that's, to me, that's really satisfying as well.
Yeah.
As a singer, never mind as an archivist, you know.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Has been able to do that, and that's just been a delight.
She wasn't meticulous with her date-keeping and entry.
No. As you'll know from reading Alleghenies, because she jumps around. It's a great little book, and it's full of story, and
I didn't have a clue where we were at. No dates, no nothing.
No, you have to use a bit of logic to try and piece it all together, and that has been one of the banes of my life, if you like, over the last 8 years, just piecing it all together. But when I've got her diaries as well, but then I'm never even really sure that the dates in the diaries are right, because, you know, she would just grab whatever was to hand to write down notes, or if she heard somebody singing a song or a pipe tune or something, she would scribble on anything. So in 1934, she could grab a diary from 1932 and scribble in the back of it, you know, so that kind of thing. So there's so much using, you know, sort of out of the box thinking and trying to piece together her story.
This is all just conjuring an image up in my mind of somebody who must have been just so enthusiastic and just really drawn in and immersed herself into everything. Mm. You know, I can just imagine her, not that I ever met her, I can just imagine this kind of, she must have been a really bubbly, full of life character and just throwing herself
absolutely
into everything.
And when you think about what she was doing, I mean, we're talking about the early 30s here. Mm-hmm. How strange it must have been for the people of South Uist to take to their hearts this kind of rather strange young American woman, you know, from somewhere totally exotic, you know, like Pittsburgh. They took her to their hearts. And I think that was all down to respect. And they respected her for what she was doing, and she respected them, obviously, for, you know, for their lives, but it was love, and you know, and that's how she described it, even till her dying day. She said, you know, that if you have real love in your life, you're very lucky. And she recognised that the people of South Uist really loved her. I mean, that's what she said. She says they loved me. You know, and you are lucky if you have real love in your life, you know, and even now to this day, you know, the respect and the love that people have for her, you know, even nearly 20 years after her death, almost in 2004, even now, they still speak of her with love and respect in South Uist, which I think is an incredible legacy on its own. Never mind the physical body of work that she left us.
It's just
the respect and that they still have for her in South Uist, which is just amazing.
Yeah. Well, maybe we could chat a bit about how she came here, and she had some chance encounters, I feel, that got her to enter into the world that she did. But something I find remarkable is the fact that she was American, you know, and John himself was, his mother was American.
His mother was American as well, yes.
Yeah. And, but sometimes I think in the Gaeltacht, we are a lot better now at recognising and valuing what we have, but just it sometimes has taken in the past people from outside to just recognize what incredible value we have in our songs and stories and language and ways of life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we all do it. You know, the things you have around you, the things you're used to, if you grow up with them, you kind of take them for granted. So, but it takes somebody coming from outside the culture, outside of the tradition, to recognise, you know, actually, you know, you've got something really special. We need to look after this. And I think that's partly what she did. There was the part of her that was looking for a home.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she felt, she described herself as a little sparrow, a little bird. And she was looking for her home. And although she was brought up, obviously, in, in the woods of Glenshaw and the fine drawing rooms of Pittsburgh and private schools in Pittsburgh. Yeah, I think she because she had been orphaned at an early age, she was looking for something that some kind of stability, some kind of something that she could make her life from, I guess. And that when she came to South Houston in 1929, she felt that this was her home. She knew when she landed, this was going to be her home. And so when she lived with Peggy and Mary McCrae, having met them by chance on New Year's Day in 1929, and in the kitchen of Boisdale House. And the head of the house there, Donald Ferguson at the time, the owner of the house, invited his cousins, Peggy and Mary. This tells you something also, by the way, to come in from the kitchen. They were in the kitchen. Although they were his cousins, they were kept in the kitchen. They were invited through to the drawing room to meet Margaret because she had expressed a desire to hear the pristine Gaelic song. So Donald Ferguson brought Peggy and Mary in, and Mary sang the song, and Margaret knew instantly this is what she was looking for, just by chance. And Mary was singing Hor Mahori Har and Talde. She knew, this is what I've been looking for. This is what I want. This is what I need to do. And that was really what set her on the path of finding the songs and keeping the songs there. So that was one of the big sort of serendipitous chance meetings, if you like, was with Mary McRae. And then, of course, her meeting with John Lorne Campbell, who was to become her husband. She was taking photos at the same time as John was living on Barra. He was living in Barra around about 1932. And he was writing The Book of Barra together with the author Compton Mackenzie.
Compton Mackenzie, yeah.
And he'd heard about this rather strange young American woman who was taking photographs and recording songs over in South Uist.
Oh, he knew about her?
He'd heard about her through the grapevine. So he knew about her. And he thought, I need photographs for my book. Need photographs for the Book of Barra. So this was in early 34. And so he spoke to the owner of the Loch Boisdale Hotel at the time, Finlay McKenzie. And Finlay engineered a chance meeting. between the two.
A chance meeting.
Between the two of them in the back smoking room of the Loch Boisdale Hotel, where Margaret was playing the piano for pipe major John MacDonald, I think it was. And he just happened to come into the back smoking room while she was playing the piano. And they got chatting eventually. So he did ask her then for photographs. And at first she said no, she wouldn't give him the photographs. But eventually, after a bit of letter wooing, shall we say, she did give him the photographs. But to her dying day, she said that he never did pay for them. absolutely. So he used the photographs, and that was really the beginning of their relationship.
Yeah.
John was quite shy young man. And I think he wasn't really, having been brought up himself in public schools, and he wasn't really used to the company of young women. And I think he found it quite hard to chat normally with her to start with.
Yeah.
So they did a lot of their initial wooing, if you like, by letter. And She writes in Allegheny's, you know, that eventually in January 1935, mm-hmm. when John had been invited out to join her for Christmas in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
He stayed for a while, but he didn't seem to want to spend much time with Margaret. He spent, as she says, he spent all his time in his room bashing away at his typewriter. Is he interested in me or not?
You know, even we've all been there.
She didn't know what was going on. Are you? Is he interested in me? I don't know. He doesn't seem to want to spend time with me. And her sisters were asking the same thing. She had four sisters, and they were saying, "Look, what's going on here? You know, are you in a relationship or are you not?" And it was only on his last day with them that he asked her to if she'd be interested. Marrying him. And so she said she was as gobsmacked as her sisters were.
That's brilliant.
But actually I have found out from our diaries and writings that intervening period between 1934 and 1935, she did write about, you know, is he the right man for me? Is there really going to be anything in this? I don't understand what's going on. So she was aware of there was something. Mm-hmm. And she also said that Mary said to me, he's a good chap. Don't let him go. So although she doesn't write about that in Allegheny's, mm-hmm. She just says, oh, it just came out of the blue. Oh my goodness, you know.
Yeah.
Actually, she did have a harbour, the hope? I'm not sure, the idea that, yes, he was interested in her. So it was a very, very kind of unusual beginning. But I always find it really interesting. I don't know if you've seen the documentary the BBC did of Margaret.
No.
Celebrate her 100th birthday.
Okay.
So this is in 2003, mm-hmm. and it's called Among Friends. And she describes their marriage as their career. She said that, you know, when she said, oh, yes, he did ask me to marry him, and that was the beginning of our career.
Oh, wow.
So she described their marriage as their career.
Yeah.
They were intensely fond of each other. You know, and that grew stronger and stronger and stronger over the years. And, you know, they had silly names for each other. I mean, we all do that, you know. But when we think of John Lauren Campbell, you know, we think of John as being the very studious, academic folklorist, you know, but the sense of fun that he had, which people don't know about. You know, he played pranks on her all the time. You know, he called her Kinky Poo or Margie Cat, or, you know, because of the cat thing. You know, they were in love their whole lives, you know, which is, you know, just wonderful, you know, to have that knowledge and her to him. You know, she liked to think she was the boss, but really John was, I think. Yeah, you know, John was the boss. You know, quietly the boss, if you like. An incredible couple that have just left us with so much. And as you say, getting back to the whole Gaelic thing, the fact that they both came from American parentage.
Mm-hmm.
Neither of them grew up with Gaelic.
Mm-hmm.
And yet look what they've left for the world.
Oh,
you know, these two Gaelic learners have left us the most important Gaelic archive. You know, and I think that's really important for learners today. Gaelic?
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
That's a lovely, lovely way of framing that. Just that there's so much opportunity and so much to contribute, no matter where you're from and what your background.
Absolutely.
You know, it's all so valuable.
Have confidence. You can do. You can do it. Anybody can do it. You know, if you want to do it, then you can, and you can make a contribution, you know, which is so important, I think, for Gaelic learners everywhere. Not just in Scotland, but everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, you can all do it. We're so lucky to have their legacy, which I hope will continue on in the years to come.
Mm-hmm.
Both the physical legacy of this amazing archive of photographs and letters, mm-hmm. and a jigsaw of archives is how I like to describe it.
Yes.
Everything's so interconnected. You know, because you've got these amazing photographs that Margaret took of people in the 1930s, but then we've got John's physical recordings of their voices.
Oh.
And then you've got the letters, the correspondence between them. You know, and as I mentioned earlier, even things like, you know, a pair of socks that Piggy maybe spun on Canna House lawn, Yeah. And, you know, what songs went into those stockings?
Yeah, and, you know, she was spinning.
So if those stockings could talk,
yeah,
what would they say?
Oh, that's a lovely thought. That's so sweet.
It makes me want to write a song, you know, that kind of thing, you know. You know, and the walls that were surrounding them. If these walls could talk, we're sitting in here in this lovely billiard room. If these walls could talk, what would they say?
Absolutely. And not just Margaret and John, but all the visitors that came here as well.
Yeah.
They were I don't know what's the right word, influential or the...
Bohemians. Kind
of bohemians, I like it.
Bohemian society, you know, they had artists and writers and politicians and dancers and musicians, everybody, particularly after the war, mm-hmm. during the 50s was their kind of heyday. And this place, this house was a hive of music and song and intellectual discussion and, you know, arguments about the state of the world. And do you know, it's just, you know, we're just so lucky.
What I would have done to have been here.
I know. Yeah. If you could be a fly in the wall then. Yes. And you know what is one of the biggest representations of that, I think, is that the series of visitors' books, which Margaret kept.
Nice.
Particularly the ones from 1930, the book from 1939 to 1954, when we had all the amazing Gaelic contributors coming, the Callum MacLeans of this mm-hmm. world, you know, the Seamus DeLargy, you know, the Seamus Ennis, the Annie Johnstons, the Compton Mackenzie, the Faith Compton Mackenzie, all these people who came and had, you know, had a glass of wine in here and
just where we are,
just where we are right now, you know, makes me want to cry, you know. It does really make me tear up when I think of it all, you know. And it's so exciting now, I think, to think, you know, that all this work has been done on Cana House to bring it back to life and to let other people in and let other people come in and see these lives and access the legacy mm-hmm. that they've left us. We're lucky that that the house is going to go through this transformation.
Yeah, we should probably mention we're sitting in Cana House at the moment with just what's about to be the beginning of a massive renovation job on the house.
There's absolutely nothing in the house now. It is completely stripped.
There's a taste of dust at the back of my throat.
is there? bare walls, bare everything. Because we're on an island, of course, doing a massive renovation project such as we're doing, we don't have places to store stuff, places to store collections, furniture, you know, the archives themselves. So it's been a 2-year project to get to this stage to construct a storage compound on the island with containers and accommodation modules for contractors to live in, and dining cabins, my own office cabin. I've been moved out of the house, obviously, so that's a whole other project just to get to this stage. Yeah. It's a massive thing, because we're logistically in a difficult place. Mm-hmm. And it's incredible now to think it's actually going to, you know, kick off, and the furniture has all been taken away to warehouses in Edinburgh.
Wow.
The archives are still here on island in storage containers for the duration. And of course, a lot of the archives are digitized as well. So, you know, we're still able to answer requests, you know, for information or copies of photographs or, you know, or sound recordings, etc. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so to try and keep that all going during the project, which will be 2 years, but we'll end up seeing Cana House as a fully functional visited property for the National Trust for Scotland, and research facilities as well. So I hope that John and Margaret would be pleased with the work, you know, that is continuing on, not just in the physical bones of the house, but with the promotion and awareness creation of the archives for everybody.
Yeah, and what a beautiful legacy that is.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Just the best.
Something just came into my mind of when we were talking of all the people coming here, but it's not just people coming here. So something, oh, I found this amazing. I was speaking recently to Mary McCarthy, piano player and accordion player from Ireland, who taught me when I was at the Academy of RCS now. That's a showing about how old I am. It was the RCMD when I was there. Anyway, and Mary used to, she used to disappear off and she would go and play on cruise ships in the Amazon. She's like, oh, I'm off to do a cruise in the Amazon. And she would go away for a few weeks at a time. And then it was only recently I reconnected with her and she said she used to come to Canna.
Yes.
To Canna House. And I was like, what? And she used to come and visit Margaret.
Yeah.
And she said, she told me a story, and it's actually mentioned in the Alleghenies book as well, where Zoltán Kodály had a Hungarian composer. Mm-hmm. Hungarian?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Had heard about Margaret.
Yes.
and the work that she was doing, and he wanted to meet with her. And so they met in the back of a music shop in London.
Yep.
I don't know the year. And they spent a few hours there looking over these songs from South Uist.
Yeah.
That Margaret had got primarily from Peggy and Mary.
Yep. Yeah.
And he, Zoltán Kodály, you know, and I think this is another thing where we, or perhaps we have thought of Gaelic being this kind of discrete tradition, but it's always been international.
Yeah.
And
we might tend to think of it being a bit parochial, possibly.
Mm-hmm.
But no, you're right. I mean, it's totally international.
Yeah. And somebody as celebrated internationally as Kodály.
Yeah.
Just went, this woman's onto something. She's doing incredible work. What are these Hebridean songs? And met with her, and she shared some of the songs. And I just think that's such a beautiful acknowledgement to the people of South Uist and their songs. And I think Margaret was particularly proud.
She was. She was. That was one of the biggest achievements of her life, was that, you know, that Kodály had wanted to meet with her and mm-hmm. to talk about these songs, and then to include them in the publishing of the
For Bartók.
Yes, the Bartók book.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's that blows my mind. Bartók and Kodály, you know, just it's amazing. It's such a wonderful acknowledgement.
It's not
for
just
Margaret, but also
the wider, the wider acknowledgement of Gaelic as being just as valuable a culture as any culture in the world.
Exactly.
You know, just incredible. And that, as I say, that was one of the biggest achievements of her life, was that meeting and the fact that the Folklore Society of England, as it was then, you know, took her to their hearts, and she had a big correspondence with them, and she presented at their conferences. She presented at conferences right across Europe and America, and she even wrote about much earlier than that, in the late 30s, when she went back to America and she took some of her films with her and presented them to her friends and her family, you know, and they were absolutely bewildered by what she had done. They did not appreciate what somebody of their own was actually doing across in Scotland. You know, they couldn't believe what they were seeing. You know, these films of these people in 1930s Barra, South Uist, Eriski, just at their daily lives, and the songs that she was collecting, they knew nothing of it, and they were just, oh my goodness, this is incredible what you're doing. I mean, she was lauded in the local newspapers in Pittsburgh,
lovely.
You know, for the work that she was doing. And I think sometimes we tend to forget in Scotland, I think, you know, as you were saying earlier, you know, you're kind of almost better known out of your backyard.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, than you are in your own backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And just what she did was amazing.
That's lovely as well, because she struggled in school academically.
Mm.
And music was her solace.
And her cats.
And her cats.
And her cats.
Oh, yes. Sorry.
Don't forget the cats.
Don't forget the cats. But
she taught herself to play the piano at the age of six.
This is really cool, because she only ever played what was it? Six sharps or something.
Yeah, she would only play in the black notes.
On the black notes. Well, yeah. Which your pentatonic scale lend itself so well to Scottish music and Gaelic music.
How did she know? I mean, it was obviously in her blood. It was in her bones from somewhere. Mm-hmm. You know, that's, and, you know, she had to teach herself, because at that point, they deemed it more important for her sisters, her elder sisters, to have the piano lessons. Mm. So she wasn't allowed to have piano lessons. So she had to teach herself. And one day she found herself playing these tunes and amazed everybody around about her. Where's this come from? So it was only after that that, you know, she began to get the proper lessons. But at age six, that's what she did. And they did have a gramophone, I think. So they had all the music that was going around at the time, and early blues and jazz, and they all had an influence on her. She just obviously had a wonderful ear, but she was what they termed a difficult child. Mm. And that was why they packed her off in the end to Scotland as a teenager, as they said, to see if the old country could sort her out.
So, well, that's a stroke of luck.
Yeah, for us, yes, and for the world. Yeah, absolutely.
Yep. And she cycled up through the Hebrides.
Yes.
She went on her bike with punctures and brakes that were hardly working and all sorts. And they just... What I loved in reading again from the Allegheny's book is she was quite to kind of just write to somebody and say, I'll be arriving.
Yeah.
Will there be somewhere for me to, you know, somewhere for me to stay? You know, these days we kind of sort an accommodation in advance and we research it all and blah, blah, blah. And she just wrote to somebody and said, you know, I'll be coming up to... Where did she go? She went to Skye.
She went to Portree and then she wrote to the minister. She found the name of the minister in Portree, wrote to the minister and said, I'm going to be coming up here. Where can I stay? You know, that kind of thing. So, she was expecting to find... She'd heard about... Well, what was the town in Skye that she'd heard about? And she thought it was going to be some great big municipality and, you know, end up a hamlet of two houses, etc. Yeah, so coming from America, this was, and even from Helensburgh at that time, I think everything was all a bit of a shock. But that's what you had to do in those days.
I think so,
you didn't have email, and I suppose telephones might have been around, but not in very many places.
Not in every house.
Uh-huh. No, definitely not. So, you know, how did you do it? You just had to rock up to somewhere and find somewhere. Yeah. Yeah. And she ended up staying in Portree, of course, for 3 months. This was slightly earlier. This was in 1926.
Before she'd gone to
live in South US. So she was desperate to get as much Gaelic as she could from Skye as well. Mm-hmm. And I think the Skye connection is really often forgotten about.
Yeah.
You know, that she did spend a lot of time in Skye, lived in Wentworth Street in Portree with the Matheson family.
Right, yeah.
And we've got a lovely photograph that she took of the Matheson family in front of their house. I'd love to find exactly which house it was. They were very kind to her and introduced her to Seton Gordon and all the important people at the time. And and so she writes very, very lovingly of her time on Skye as well. Yeah. But, you know, much as she loved it, she just... There wasn't quite enough of what she was looking for.
Yeah.
Even then, I think she felt that Portree was too big.
Yeah.
That she wasn't quite what she was looking for. So
she knew what she was looking for.
She did. She did. Even if she couldn't articulate it.
No. Exactly.
But she writes so amazingly of all her travels there and all the adventures that they had, and then when you team them now with the photographs I've done a lot of work on this, teaming the photographs up with Allegheny's, because they don't all appear in Allegheny's, obviously, you know, and there's sneaky ones of her with her friends on Skye and they're having a quick fly puff and a cigarette.
Oh, nice.
Kind of thing, you know, and just amazing photographs.
That's brilliant.
Just, you know, wonderful. Wonderful. To think that she ended up, you know, just living for 60 years just off the coast of Skye.
It's wonderful.
And she'd never heard of Cana, of course. And it was John that decided to buy Cana.
Yeah.
She was in hospital in Edinburgh and he just announced, well, I bought Cana. So we're moving to Cana. And she said, oh, that's great. Lovely. Super. You know, as one did, I suppose, in those times. Goodness me.
Brilliant. Just bought an island while you were in hospital.
I know. Just bought an island, yeah.
Let's talk a wee bit about the book then. So, not the Alleghenies, but the folk songs. Folklore of South Uist. I think this is maybe one of the first books I got in university when I was studying music, studying singing, and this was one of the first ones in my collection. I was studying with Kenna Campbell, as who you know very well, along with your daughter Katie. Yes. Both of us were at uni together. And this was an absolute staple of our kind of repertoire. And but it's more than songs. It's a remarkable book.
It is.
And I remember just recently going and reading the introduction. When I first contacted you about having this conversation, I was reading the introduction and it's so beautifully written. The description of Uist and life in Uist and from, I mean, she learned a lot about all the boats and the different parts of the boat, didn't she? And cutting the peat and the potatoes and everything like this, the whole life really conjured a nostalgic feeling to me. Now, I can't claim that was my upbringing. You know, I was born in the 80s. I'm born in the age of, well, pre-internet. I've been brought up in a totally bilingual world. I don't think any of us can claim anymore to have... There aren't many, anyway, who can claim to have had this really traditional upbringing. Yeah. Yet it kind of evoked the sense of nostalgia in me, this really, really Gaelic, life. And I think perhaps my own childhood had elements of that.
Yeah.
And the people I knew, the kind of older folk in my community that I come from, had so many old people. I would just... walk into their house and bake with them and probably a bit precocious myself. And I think the life that they had better reflected what I was reading. And I just felt like, almost like the Keanalists, you know, this kind of yearning and homesickness for this life, even though it wasn't my life. And that, I think, is my way of trying to acknowledge how beautifully written that introduction is.
It totally is. It's like a tapestry of a life.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, when she talks about all the traditions and, you know, and it's not written from an academic point of view. You can tell that she was immersed in that lifestyle.
Oh, yeah.
You know, she was the one lighting the peats for them to carry on Halloween, you know, that kind of thing, you know, that Mary had given her the recipe for the fuarach or whatever it was that they were going to be having. And it was all written with a love for the people that she was writing about, I think, you know. And like you, Folk Songs and Folklore of South Uist was my first Gaelic song Bible.
Yeah.
And it was really, I went to the first Keolis festival in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
1996, yes, it was the first one. And it was at that point, because I had only been singing in Gaelic for four years at that point, 3 or 4 years. So I was very much still at the learner stage. But I bought my first copy of Folk Songs and Folklore at the Keolis Festival. And instantly, as you say, it was the introduction that grabbed me.
Yeah.
Not just the songs. It's more than just the songs. It's a songbook, but it's the whole tapestry of life. And I recognised immediately that this is what I wanted to do. Like her, finding, looking for the pristine song. I read the introduction to the book and I thought, this is amazing. This is incredible. I mean, there's a few photographs in the book, but they're kind of just, they add to it, obviously. But it was the descriptive. She's so good at telling a story, story through words and making you envisage what she's trying to tell you, you know. It's just the most incredible tapestry of life in the 1930s in South Uist.
This cracked me up, actually. I'm going to have to read to you some of the kind of cures that she's got as well, because there's kind of cures for ailments for people and animals in it. Right. Okay, so this is brilliant. Hang on a second while I open this up. Right. Right.
You've got hay fever today. There's probably a cure in there for hay fever.
Yeah, exactly. It might help me out.
I've tried some of them and they work. They do work.
Well, have you tried this one? Wait, I can't find. Oh, here we go. Shan Leishin, old cures. So there's cures for cold blister and a sore throat and earache, headache, asthma, and so on. But there is. Here we go for stomach ache.
Oh, yes, I know the one you mean.
When a patient is in desperation, and there's initials as well, SC. So these must be people that she collected these from. Yes. Okay.
So what does it say? S-E? Okay.
S-C.
S-C. That'll be Seamus Kimble.
Seamus Kimble. Oh, yeah. She mentioned Seamus Kimble. Okay. So Seamus Kimble told Margaret, when a patient is in desperation, put a rope around his feet and hang him by the heels from the rafters. Repeat at reasonable intervals. This will undo the knot in the guts.
I think the reasoning behind that is, if you're hung upside down for a length of time, you'll stop feeling your sore stomach and you'll be too worried about your sore head or surviving, I guess, rather than just your sore stomach. Yeah.
Fair enough. Okay, I hadn't thought of it like that. There are other ones as well. I mean, there's a lot that mentions kind of plants boiling, some local plants, and taking the water and using that as a medicine and whatnot.
Or using it for dyeing, getting colours.
There's an amazing section. Colours. The recipes for the dyeing of wool is the next section. And it's fantastic.
And then traditional food recipes as well. You know, she's got the recipes for the special cakes for feast days, etc. For your, you've got your struan for Michaelmas, which I have made.
Oh,
I have followed her recipes to the T, and they do, except not over the open fire as she talks about. I'm afraid, unfortunately. But yes, they work. Yeah, so I on Michaelmas Day, I always make a struan.
That's lovely.
I'll need to try it out. I've never tried it.
But she's got like prayers and she's got
runes and
Dúin ballads and Hogmanay ballads. I love that. Dúin Cailleac and Dúin Cailín. Yeah, really nice. And she's got old proverbs that she's collected as well, which are fantastic.
Oh, they are.
But then the most of the body of the book is these songs, and like you say, the kind of little songs. They're not little, but they were deemed little songs, which have just been invaluable to so many singers. Yeah. I wonder, you know, it'd be amazing now to look at singers recently who have recorded and... You know, how many singers have recorded on their albums?
Well, do you know,
using this book?
I wanted to do a piece of research into this.
Oh.
Was to take a sample of contemporary singers and to actually look at their repertoire and work out what percentage of their repertoire has originally come from South US, from folk songs and folklore.
Amazing.
I just think it would be so interesting to find out. And I might do it yet, because there would be so much, you know. I think it would just be incredible, and I think it would be such testament to her. So we could look at that together. There's a project for us.
Right,
that's our next project. Okay.
but first, Fiona, we've got another project to work on first, though, and that's the movie of her life.
Yes. Because, I mean, as I said, you know, the life of John and Margaret Campbell of Cana, it is a Hollywood blockbuster. So if there's anybody out there who's intrigued by this whole story, please get in touch. Because it's got everything that makes a blockbuster. It's got love. It's got a little bit of sex. It's got the money. It's got the landscapes. It's got the music. You can just see the opening titles, can't you?
Oh.
Sweeping over the Macher of South Euston.
Yeah.
You know, the bluebells gently wafting in the soft summer breeze.
Oh.
The smell of the Macher coming over you, and the Canachan Clave in the background, that's bog cotton, and you know, and Margaret coming trudging along behind a cow, or you know, whatever. Always in a skirt, she didn't wear trousers, of course, you know, in the tweeds. And then you've got this handsome young, rather shy young tall Scotsman, you know, who was a bit
Mr. Darcy.
Yeah, Mr. Darcy. Yeah, I just think it, and the whole story is just amazing. You've got the international element, you know. We haven't even got on to the whole Basque connection at
another
all.
Another massive connection.
So going from country to country, and the people who came here, and the colourful people, and it's a film. Definitely a film. Yeah.
Amazing. Let's talk about the Basque connection, because today's a really pertinent day. Today's a very special day. It's the third anniversary.
It is.
Of the death of Magda, who was incredibly important to John and Margaret, and incredibly important to this story in Cana.
So. She was. Magda Sigurdarzu was born in the Basque Country. Her father, Saturnino Sigurdarzu, was John's best friend from his teenage years. As we mentioned earlier, John's mother was American, and she had an estate, a private estate, just outside Biarritz, obviously in the Basque Country. And Saturnino was employed on the estate as an estate worker. So when John would go out to Biarritz as a child and his teenage years for his holidays, they became very friendly with Saturnino. So they kind of grew up together through some troubled times, and you know, in Spain and France, obviously. But they remained very good friends. Mm-hmm. And then Saturnino's wife and Magda's mother died at a young age in 1957, I think it was, leaving Magda and her sister Maria Carmen as young girls. Again, still in troubled times in Spain. So in 1962, Saturnino decided to bring the girls to Cana and see how they, if they could regain some kind of equilibrium in their lives. So they came here. And Magda in particular fell in love with Cana. And really, she never left. She, through all her teenage years, she would spend all her holidays here helping John with the cataloguing and with all the transcribing and everything to do with the archives. She went back to Spain to train as a teacher for a time, and she had an art gallery for a time. She's very artistic. But her heart was always here on Cana. And so eventually she moved back here permanently to help John building up the catalogue. And when he died in 1996, she moved in here permanently with Margaret to look after her, but also to help her continue John's work and her own work. So she lived here in Cana House with Margaret, devoted her whole life to Cana in one way or another. The most incredibly inspirational woman you could ever hope to meet. She was my best friend. I first met her in 2011 when I was working for the National Theatre of Scotland, and I was doing a play about Margaret. So as part of that, I came here to Cana to research with Magda. We clicked. You know, I think although I had never been to the Basque Country, she just managed to inspire me completely with her love and devotion and commitment to John and Margaret and their work. Just the most incredible woman. I mean, bubbly, effervescent, full of passion, life and love, and just the most wonderful woman you could ever hope to meet. So she became my best friend. And she had wanted to retire for some years, but had never felt that there was anybody that she could entrust the archives to, somebody who got John and Margaret's work as they deserved to be. who really understood it, not just from an archive point of view, but from the musical point of view and a singer's point of view and the Gaelic. So it was one day in 2014, she just phoned me up and she says, Fiona, and she, you know, she spoke with her hands all the time. So I'm waving my hands around like Magda would do, you know. She said, Fiona, she said, I have decided I am retiring now. I am going to retire now. The job will be advertised next week and you will apply. So I did. And I was amazing. Privileged enough to get the job. So I came here and Magda handed the key to me to Cana House. And that was the start of our career, having talked about John, that was the start of our career together.
But, yeah, I think that, you know, when you're saying, like, Margaret's life, she was destined to be here.
Mm-hmm.
Magda was destined mm-hmm. to come here. And you were destined to take that
yeah.
on.
With my own sort of educational background, you know, I had the librarian side of me, but I also had the music side and the yeah. Gaelic side. And I kind of felt that my whole life's career had been drawing me in one way yeah. or another towards Cana. And so Magda was my inspiration, you know, and she helped me. She was so generous with her knowledge of the collections and the archives. And she could have been quite, you know, kept it to herself and, you know, it was hers. But, you know, she wanted me to have as much of her knowledge, you know, to drain her brain. She kept saying, you must drain my brain. You must get the knowledge from me, you know. And so we had a lovely few years here on Cana when I first came, with me just downloading her brain, basically. If I could have done, plugged her in, then I would have done. And then very sadly, she passed away from cancer in 3 years ago today in the Basque Country. So every year on the anniversary of her death, we fly the Basque flag in the garden here.
Yep.
And I think she would be proud. I think she would be delighted to know that we are remembering her. She didn't think of herself as being the keeper of the flame, which is like how I like to describe her. But she was. She was very, very reserved in that terms. You know, she appreciated exactly what we had mm-hmm. so much more. And she wanted us to have that. But she didn't boast about her knowledge. You know, she just made sure that we had it. And, you know, I don't know that I'll ever meet another woman like her. But she deserves to be remembered just as much as Margaret
yeah.
and John. You know, because without Magda, we would not have what we have, you know, today. And I'm delighted, so privileged to have had her in my life, even for that relatively short time. I'll never forget her. Never forget her. She's as part of Cana as John and Margaret are.
Yeah. I think to sum up, what just resonates in all of this is love. Like you
it
said
is,
earlier.
Isn't it? It is all yeah. love, isn't it?
It's, you know, and you were saying Margaret had deep love for the people around mm. her and they had love for her. Yet we have, you know, you have a clear love for Magda and for this place here, this very, very special place. And, you know, and we all can share that.
We have to.
And feel that love as well for what they've all done.
Absolutely.
And left us, and it's wonderful. And let's hope that we continue to sing these songs and kind of just immerse ourselves as much as we can in yep. what has been left for us.
Honour their work.
Yes.
Honour their work with love.
Yeah. Oh, Fiona, thank you so, so much. It's been a real pleasure. This is... To be in this situation is really special, and I know it's super special for you. So
it is.
Thank you.
Thank you, Taplif.
Thanks to Fiona for such a heartfelt and open chat about a remarkable woman who fearlessly and ambitiously followed her intuition, entered boldly into the unknown and relished every opportunity afforded to her, all of which has culminated in a hugely important and invaluable legacy for so many of us to relish today. I'm still pinching myself that I got the chance to record the interview in Cana House itself, To have a look around before it closed for extensive renovations was truly a memorable and impactful experience. I hope that you enjoyed our conversation. If so, please remember to like, share, review and subscribe to this podcast. Every little bit really does help. The music you hear is taken from my album Urunthe, which is available through my website www.teardrigrion.com, as well as on the usual streaming platforms. I'd like to extend my grateful thanks to the Tascag Fund from Fashion and Gael for supporting this series. And finally, don't go quite yet, there's a tiny bit more still left. Until the next time, Bian Lach Leif. Is there any particular song that jumps out at you from the book? Any favourites?
Well, there's lots of favourites. But I think probably my absolute favourite from folk songs is the song that was Margaret's favourite. And it was always the one that she used as her party piece.
Oh.
You know, if they were having a wee soiree or ceilidh in the drawing room, you know, she would sit at the piano. And this was always a song that she would play. She wasn't a singer, you know, but, you know, obviously she did sing, but she wasn't a performing singer at all. But her favourite song was An Gile Dhann, or The Brown-Haired Lad, and it's a Cana song. And there are not actually that many defined songs from Cana. Lots of songs which mention Cana, but I haven't actually come across more than a couple of actual songs that have been written, you know, by a Cana person.
And would she have collected that before she lived here?
Or well, she collected it in South Uist.
In South Uist,
because it was sung by Peggy McRae.
Oh, amazing.
And we do actually have a tiny little recording of her on her 100th birthday at her 100th birthday party, which we had in Cana in 2003.
Lovely.
And Magda actually videoed Margaret at the piano. She was playing it beautifully, very simply. She was blind by that time, so it was all from memory. And she was playing it for herself, not for the people around about her. She was playing it for herself, and she just sang the last line of An Gile Dhann to herself at the piano, and that's the only clip that we have of her actually singing.
That's so special.
It's a beautiful song, and it was her favourite. And you know, we're just very lucky to have that tiny, tiny little bit that we've got.
Oh, thank you.